It's really interesting to see how these companies are approaching Chicago, right?
She was telling me she's really trying to understand how the tech ecosystem here works.
What's interesting about the baby boomers is that they've never met a debt they didn't like.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Hey, welcome to Monday afternoon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch in the Allstate Skyline Studio, high atop the Chicago River, which was steaming again today on this March 4th, when with any luck at all, we'll get into double digits a little bit later. Speaking of double digits, we're going to look at your 401k in the second half hour. Elise Glink will be here. Fidelity released some numbers about where average 401ks are and where median numbers are by decade. And so we'll just sort of give a little checkup to see if you're where, I don't know if it's where you should be or where other people your age are. But we'll start by asking Jim Dahlke about his 401k. Jim is a senior editor at ChicagoInno.com, comes by on most Mondays. Welcome back.
Hey, Steve.
Nice to see you.
Good to be here. Happy Monday.
Thank you very much. It makes no sense doing this job that I should watch Shark Tank, you would think, right? But it's a show I've never seen before. We talk a lot about when there are Chicago companies that are on it, and last night was one of those cases.
That's right, yeah. You know, Shark Tank is one of those shows that I've found myself liking more recently. I mean, I know it's 10 years into this season now, or into the show now.
Is that
now,
right? It's been 10 years?
Yeah, 10 years of Shark Tank, believe it or not. Yeah, but yeah, that show is so just like snackable and bingeable that we'll just, me and my wife will spend a Saturday just like crushing like 4 hours of Shark Tank. But so yeah, you know, every now and then a Chicago company comes through the show, and we've seen it pretty regularly actually. Every year a few businesses will swing through. And yeah, we had our latest Chicago startup on the show on Sunday night, and the company was called Curl Mix.
And that is a product to wash curly hair. It's a curly hair shampoo.
Yeah, so it's a beauty product for women with curly hair. So basically their kind of secret sauce is they feature just 12 ingredients, but mainly from flaxseed oil.
Okay.
So a product that is really designed for people to kind of boost their already curly hair, make it even more curly and pop a little more.
My wife has curly hair, and she has, I think, unique products for that, which I was not aware of until just recently.
They are among several competitors in the space, but they have some pretty interesting traction. So they launched recently, but just last year, they did $1 million in sales. So nothing to slouch at in terms of an early startup.
And what I like is they are social media driven, right? It's a husband and wife team.
Right.
And the wife, Kim, does online tutorials about how to deal with curly hair.
Exactly.
And that sells the product.
Yeah, I mean, the product sort of sells itself, right? So yeah, they don't have any brick and mortar presence. They're really kind of going all in on online, which does sort of separate itself from some of the competitors that are kind of operating similarly to them.
Okay, so they were on the show last night on Shark Tank. How'd they do?
So they went in asking for a $400,000 investment for 10% equity. All the sharks dropped out except for Robert, who offered them $400,000 at 20% equity.
Okay.
So, still trying to get a little bit more skin in the game for himself. And they actually turned that deal down.
Really?
So they declined, and they left the tank without a deal. So, you know, sometimes the next best thing to, you know, getting a Shark Tank deal is actually not getting a Shark Tank deal, because a lot of these deals end up requiring these founders to give up a lot of their stake in their business. So I was actually kind of excited to see a company with a great idea, a great business traction behind it, actually decline giving away a fifth of their business.
I know some of the guys from Spikeball, and they've been on the show, and they're Bishop McNamara guys by and large. And they did that, right? They turned, and in fact, they told me at the time, it's like, we wanted to keep more control over had we sacrificed that control, who knows where we'd be right now.
Exactly. And I think Spikeball's deal was actually on the episode, they accepted the deal, but I think behind the scenes
it fell apart,
which
right.
actually happens pretty frequently. That's happened to a couple of different Chicago startups. Parachute was one of the last ones where she accepted the deal on camera, and then sort of the deals fall through behind the scenes.
Doing the fine print.
I love this detail that Tim, one of the founders of the company of Curl Mix, gave during the episode last night. He, a couple years ago, was actually on an episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, won $100,000, and then used that money to seed what is now Curl Mix, and basically used that for startup capital.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Two national television appearances.
Yeah.
And it's funding his business.
Right. What a 21st century startup funding story, right? Getting it through your reality TV winnings.
Right. Okay, I was joking with Bill and Wendy that there's a company called Encounter AI, and they are working on a robot to take your order at the fast food window, and that their accuracy is 85%, and it seems to me that's higher than what we get with humans.
So yeah, Encounter AI is basically like Siri or Alexa, but for the drive-through ordering window. And yeah, their system right now, they say it's about 85%. Still early days. They've got it in a few different Midwest fast food restaurants across Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Louis. And you know, you don't think 85% maybe necessarily is that great, but they say that the average, you know, drive-through ordering window attendant is about 70% accurate.
So I was joking, but it's true.
It is true. That's what their data says.
Wow.
So really, though, the biggest problem that they're finding is that the AI can pretty much handle anything with in terms of, hey, I'd like a number one with fries and a Sprite. Mm-hmm. What it can't do is when you say something like, hey, how's your day going? Or I'd like two bottom buns on my Big Mac. So
right.
Basically, the really specific inquiries that kind of go to quote unquote off script or where it gets in trouble.
So it would do well in the Northeast where people aren't so friendly.
Yeah.
And very badly in the South where everyone wants to know how your day has been.
Yeah, the pleasantries can kind of trip up the robot.
And for the, well, so in the pitch sort of is that this would allow the restaurant workers to then do more valuable work. But come on, this is going to replace these
restaurants. Is going to replace jobs. I mean, and they don't, you know, shy away from that. I mean, what they find is, you know, they're working kind of at the franchisee level. So they're talking with these franchisee owners and they see the cost of labor skyrocketing and see this cost of food going up. You know, their argument is that, you know, a lot of the choices from some of these franchisee owners is that, you know, we can either reduce work or shut down completely. And what they say too, what Encounter AI says, is that, you know, this will replace some jobs, but also moves people off a very sort of menial task of being working the drive-thru and to move them to something more high value,
like
right?
Making french fries,
or maybe working with the artificial intelligence, right? Maybe you're kind of on staff to make sure the maintenance of the AI is working all right. Maybe you're making sure that it's being implemented correctly.
And you know, I don't think we need to apologize for replacing people all the time. This is a pretty prime target for where artificial intelligence would work well. And you write in the story that these franchisees deal with huge worker turnover.
It's one of the industries that sees the highest work turnover of any industry. And actually, the fast food industry itself is currently in the midst of one of its highest turnover rates in years. So it's an industry that sees this a ton. What this can do is can stabilize things a little bit for franchisees where their margins are already pretty thin.
And they are in how many stores now?
So they are working with three of the top 20 fast food brands. So they've got NDAs with all these guys, so they didn't name who they are, but they are well-known fast food brands you would recognize, and they are in several cities throughout the Midwest kind of working on a franchisee basis.
Right, so it's the sort of thing that McDonald's isn't going to sign something with them, but a McDonald's franchisee might do it.
Right, and I expect you'll see is that once they get that 85% accuracy closer to 90, 95, 99, that's when they'll start to maybe do some large-scale rollouts.
And this is a place where this is going to happen. If we can make restaurant reservations and not know if we're talking to a human, we can order a McBurger.
You know, it's not that it's not that different than, you know, you go to McDonald's and you place the order on their new digital screens, right? You say this, and basically the voice system is essentially doing just that.
Jim Dahlke is in a studio, and we're talking Jim from ChicagoInno.com, and of course the host of the Inno Minute, which is on every morning on the opening bell with Steve Grzana. Right about 5:25.
That's right.
All right. Welcome back. Tell me about this pacifier. Well, there's a phrase here, spit in your eye.
So this startup is called Nuovo, and what it's really made is a quote-unquote smart pacifier. And so really what that does at the base level is measure for an infant's acid reflux and takes their temperature. So it's measuring the acid level of their saliva and is kind of like a just always on thermometer, which is kind of cool.
And this comes from a young guy whose little brother, right, had this problem.
Yeah, basically his little brother, you know, sort of spit or up in his dad's face and it was burning his dad's eye. And he was like, this is something wrong with this, right? There's no way that this saliva should be this acidic. And that's how they knew to take him into the hospital and get it checked for acid reflux. And so basically what their new patent pending pacifier can do is measure that early on, detect this kind of stuff early and before it's too late.
Now this is, so he's early on in the process, right? He's not even.
So we're patent pending and it needs to still be FDA approved. So there's still a lot of hoops to get through for this. But you imagine, I mean, what a tool in the tool belt for new parents, you know, to kind of have to be able to sort of measure these things. You know, it's funny. My brother-in-law and his wife just had twins. So babies are like very much on the forefront of our family's mind right now. And so, you know, as a new parent, you're very worried about, is this right? Is this right? Is this right? So being able to have kind of a tool like that, that can sort of digitally tell how a baby's temperature is doing or acid reflux is doing, is a really, really big thing to have.
And it's smart to go into this business because new parents will buy anything.
Anything. That's right.
Speaking of parents buying things, my son for Christmas wanted a pair of Allbirds shoes, mm-hmm. and he got them, is very happy with them. But that's predominantly online, right?
That's right. Yeah. So they're a fashion startup, e-commerce startup. And, you know, the way that we're kind of seeing, you know, digital retail, you think about it in terms of predominantly online, but a lot of these e-commerce startups are building brick and mortar shops. So the Allbirds is going to have a Chicago shop in the Bucktown neighborhood, which is kind of joining a group of growing e-commerce companies that want to have a physical retail space. And so you're seeing that not just in Chicago, but I think across the country. And so this idea that, you know, digital is going to totally wipe out brick and mortar, I think has been a little premature.
So why is it that an online shop that is successful needs a brick and mortar store? I mean, if they got an international reach online, why is it that they're going to build a store in Chicago?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One, it's marketing. You know, as people walk down a busy street, right? Exactly. You're walking down a busy street. You're further interacting with a brand, right? I mean, the internet is a extremely crowded place. You come across a lot of e-commerce, right? So being able to have a physical space allows people who are walking down busy streets to interact with your brand. And being able to just like expand across the country too. I mean, being able to get, you know, an e-commerce brand, not just in LA or New York, but come to the Midwest, interact with a huge part of the population you might not normally see. So I think Allbirds is actually going to introduce a brand new Chicago limited edition shoe. It's kind of got the Cubs sort of blue and red colors that they're going to be launching when this store officially opens later this week.
I was just looking to get the name right, but Foxtrot is an example of that, right? We've had the CEO, couple of guys started Foxtrot. They were an online curator of fine foods and beverages, and they've got now, I think they've moved into Texas as well.
Yeah, so Foxtrot was doing, you know, on-demand delivery. Think of alcohol, everyday food items, convenience store items.
But late at night.
Yeah, and so they've got brick-and-mortar shops across Chicago now. So they're a really interesting Chicago story in that they've kind of created these little cafe, almost lounge areas. People can come and drink a beer or drink a coffee, and really have kind of proven that, you know, the brick-and-mortar retail experience is a big part of their business.
All right, so there's that. In a story that, I don't want to say it won't go away because it shouldn't go away, but another study of women in tech in Chicago shows that are we lagging nationally? Are we kind of fitting in nationally? Either way, the numbers are too low.
Yeah, you know, there's reports and rankings all the time of how does X city stack up for women in tech, and Chicago has fared well in some of those and not so well in some of those. But this new study from the Illinois Tech Association really kind of takes a look at some of the hard stats around this, and they found in a study of 300 Chicago tech CEOs, just 6% were women, which does fall below the national average. And so, yeah, really, when you look at it, that number should be way, way higher. Right. And the problem about it, too, is that when you look at VP level, we're at about 26% women. And then it cuts about in half again when you look at the C-suite. Just about 13% of Chicago's C-suite executives in tech are women. And then you cuts it almost half again when you look at the number CEOs.
I saw the just seeing the headline, I wondered, Amanda Lannert must be tired of reading her name in articles. She's the CEO of Jellyfish, because people always point to her, but they always point to her because there aren't a lot of others to point to.
We need more examples, right, of success of women in tech, right? So Amanda is doing a terrific job at Jellyvision, and I think that she would probably certainly agree that there needs to be more Amanda Lannerts in Chicago.
Jim Dahlke, the senior editor at ChicagoInno.com, thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks very much, David Jennings. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, we talk about retirement on the show, and when we do, we talk about how more and more people are retiring to something, right? You don't end your job, you retire to something else. People keep working longer and longer. Well, why can't you retire to something at the place where you already work? It's sort of what Liz Weston has been writing about. She's a certified financial planner, columnist at nerdwallet.com, and she joins us on a phone line now. Liz, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. It's great to be here.
Okay, so, right, the idea is if you're a worker and you're nearing retirement, maybe you don't want to quit altogether, but you want to ease into it. And you write that employers do a sort of a bad job of fostering that or of growing that.
Yeah, right now what's called phased retirement is really the exception rather than the rule. And what phased retirement does is allow the worker to transition to part-time work and then eventually to quit. And it gives the companies time, you know, gives them a heads up that somebody's planning to retire, so they have time to transfer knowledge, maybe to do some mentorships in the meantime. And the person who's doing the phased retirement gets to get used to it, both financially and in terms of, you know, how they spend their time. They're not just dropping from full-time work to no work, which
right.
can be a pretty tough transition.
Right, right. You write that 1 in 10 large employers offer phased retirement programs right now. Fewer than 1 in 3 of the companies surveyed by, I think it's Willis Towers Watson, surveyed found that their employees offer their employees the option to work part-time or switch to a less demanding job. Liz, I have to tell you, I had my eyes on retirement, like, oh, one day, and then I happened to have been home for almost 2 solid weeks during the holidays. I'm like, no, I can't do that. There's no way I could do that.
Was that your wife saying that as well, or your partner?
No.
It's like, no, you're not going to be underfoot.
Trust me, my wife works out of the house, so she really doesn't want me to retire.
I sympathize.
But it's true, isn't it? I mean, the idea of jumping full-time into full-time retirement is difficult, and this seems to be a nice little opportunity that is maybe not getting the attention it deserves.
Yeah, I think some people actually will have to work into retirement. There are a lot of people that just haven't got enough saved, so it's going to be an economic thing. But honestly, even if you really love your job and, you know, want to hang in there, you might not physically be able to do it. And, you know, having the part-time option is terrific. And then, as you pointed out, a lot of us get a lot of our self-esteem, a lot of our social interaction. There's a lot coming from our job that we may not fully realize until it's taken away. And there, you know, the stories of people who retire and then keel over, you know, within
right.
a year or two,
right.
or simply are not enjoying themselves because they had this fantasy of what retirement would be like, and it's nothing like the reality.
So
something for a lot of us to consider.
It might be driven if more workers were asking for it, but you write that a lot of times workers might be kind of afraid to ask for it.
Yeah, you don't want to be singled out as the one who's, you know, halfway out the door. I think that's part of the problem, is people don't want to ask for this because they don't want to be next on the chopping block if there's going to be layoffs. And, you know, to be anything less than 100% committed to your company is considered not a good thing. But then, on the other hand, employers don't know that there's a real demand for this, which there is, because the employees aren't asking for it. It's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing here. I'm not sure exactly how to solve that. One of the people that I talked to, though, said if you want to be in a good position to ask for this, you need to be sort of a superstar player. You know, if you are somebody that the company wants to hang on to, they're much more willing to listen to your proposal and
right.
this idea
so,
than if you're not a high performer.
So the better idea is to be valuable. You'll have more clout if you do that than if you're phoning it in and they would say, well, we won't miss them for 20% of the time anyway.
Exactly. Right. That's what you want to aim for, is to be the one they want to keep.
So you write about these programs from the Government Accountability Office. Are these official government programs, or where do these possibilities come from? I'm not sure I understand that.
Oh, yeah. The Government Accountability Office was doing sort of a general check around to private companies to see what private companies were offering.
And that was
all the different ones that I mentioned, like the one that allows you to cut back by 20%. There's one that, you know, you construct your own glide path from 100% to 0% work. But the federal government does now offer this, and the uptake has not been huge. NASA is really into it. That's probably who's getting the most people to sign up for the phased-in retirement. Interestingly enough, Social Security decided not to offer this.
Really?
So that's kind of a little bit of an ironic twist there, that the one office that should understand how important this is to retirement is not offering phased retirement.
So what is it that the government's offering, that you can start to retire at 55 with 10-year service and cut your pay by 20% and your hours by 20%?
I'm not sure if that's the actual
one? Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it's set up, but I do know that with all these programs, you have to get your supervisor to sign off. So that's another thing, is you want to cultivate your supervisor.
Right, so you want to be, again, you don't want to be too valuable. You want your supervisor to look good, but you don't want to make him look too good, because then he won't let you retire too early.
That's right.
What percentage of us are sort of on track, are ready for retirement when the time comes, you know?
It kind of depends on how you're doing the measurement. I think most of the reliable estimates I've seen are about fewer than half of us are on track, really, not to have a fairly substantial drop in our standard of living. That's how they've been looking at it. Not necessarily income, because you don't need as much income in retirement. You're not paying for commuting and things like that. But, you know, only about half of us or fewer are really going to be on track to keep our standard of living going at the same level once we retire.
One of the statistics that jumped out at me from your story was the fact that almost half of us retire before we plan to because of things out of our control.
Exactly. And you hear all these people saying, oh, I'm just going to, you know, work until I die, either as because they love work, but the vast majority because they don't think there's an option. The reality is you probably won't be able to do that. Most people, a lot of people who retire sooner than they think, and sometimes several years sooner, which if you know about financial planning, you know, even a year or two can make a huge difference in the ability of your savings to support you. So that's a big deal.
We're talking about people who lose their job late in their career, right, or they have to care for loved ones or things like that.
Yeah, most often it's a layoff. It's a health situation either for themselves or for a loved one. It's something that they didn't really anticipate, which is why we keep telling people, have a plan B. Don't just assume you'll be able to work as long as you want to.
All right, let's look five years down the road. Do you think there will be more phased-in retirement programs then?
I think there will be, but the uptake, as I said, been really slow. So it's something that I think more people should be looking into and maybe, you know, trying. I think more companies should be offering this, definitely. But I think more people who are in a position to ask for it should be pushing this to make the companies realize that this is something that could benefit them as well as individual workers.
Yeah, it works for the companies. You've got the experience around training the workforce. Liz Weston, the certified financial planner, columnist at NerdWallet. Great to talk to you. I hope we can talk again soon.
I do too. Thanks, Steve.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. International Women's Day. It's this week on Friday, March 8th, and 1871 is celebrating one of the most important days of the year with a whole day of events. Literally, a whole day. It kicks off with a breakfast revolving around the theme of Balance is Better, where CEO Betsy Ziegler starts it off with a chat with the chief digital officer from Charles Schwab. And the final event starts at 3:45, closing things out with a reception and networking event. But let's be honest, this shouldn't just be limited to one day. We should be celebrating awesome, powerful women in and out of business every single day. And speaking of awesome women, WGN's very own Amy Guth has partnered up with Cranes to provide you with a rundown of the most important business happenings in and around Chicago called The Daily Gist. In the podcast, she'll be chatting with a cast of Cranes reporters, touching on every industry, making sure that you know the sides of the story that mean the most to you. So keep your eyes peeled at chicagobusiness.com. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank on 720 WGN. Elise Glink is on the phone line. Elise, I almost forgot what I was going to say there. I almost fumbled.
There's just a lot of news going on today, Steve.
There is a lot of news today. Publisher Elise is the publisher of ThinkLink.com, the CEO of Best Money Moves as well, an HR app for businesses that help their workers measure their financial stress and then deal with it. And I think probably a lot of financial stress comes over 401ks. Fidelity's out with its numbers, and it says that the average 401k is $106,500. The median 401k is just $24,800. And then in this article I was reading, it said pretty quickly that those numbers might not, they're not so helpful, right? I mean, if the average is 106,000, that varies, your needs vary greatly if you're 65 years old or if you're 26 years old.
It does, and let's just be honest, having an average 401k of $106,000 anyway isn't going to get you too far
right
down the line.
That's what I was thinking.
So It's an expensive world. The difference between, of course, average and median, average is taking all of them and then dividing by the number of 401k accounts out there. The median is the same, the middle point of the same number above or below. And if the median is $24,000, that just tells you that the vast majority of Americans don't have much in there.
Yeah. So if there were 100 workers at a company, 50 of them would have more than 24,800 and 50 of them would have fewer.
Correct.
So then what do we do with these numbers? I mean, the average 401k savings, if you're 30 to 39, is just $16,500. 40 to 49 is $36,900. I mean, do they all share the fact that the average or the median is lower than where we need to be?
I think it does. I mean, when you think about just the cost of health care and retirement, the cost of health care is estimated to be somewhere between $250,000 to $300,000 per person in retirement of expenses that are not covered by Medicare or Medicaid. And so when you think about what that cost really is and what it does to, you know, your regular savings, and you realize you're not even getting, you don't have that in your 401k, you might get a little concerned about where you're going to be able to buy your next pills from or with what. So I think that people, you know, the younger you are, the better it is, right? You need to save less overall if you start when you're 22 or 23 or 24 than if you start saving for retirement when you're in your 50s.
I read somewhere there was a rule of thumb that by 30 you should have half to a full amount of your annual salary in your retirement fund. Is that familiar to you?
Well, it's sort of a misguided approach, I think. So if you start when, it's not a bad, I mean, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true, but, you know, the thing you have to think about that's different from when we used to use those rules of thumb is that people are living a lot longer today. So you're working in retirement, or there is no real retirement. You're thinking you're going to just keep working until you're in your 70s or 80s or even 90s. Which is great because the average family is now living to their mid-80s. A married couple is much more likely to live to their mid or late 80s. And frankly, 20, 30, 40 years ago, that just wasn't the case. So the amount of time you have to save if you start, if you're young, is long, but you have to actually get to the savings part of it.
Right, and the key is just to save whatever you can as soon as you can, and that will continue to grow. I was also reading in this article that the women pay scale for women tends to peak at age 39, and for men it's age 48. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, you know, there's some interesting numbers coming out about women in the workforce. This is March 8th is Women's Day, I think International Women's Day, and I just saw some numbers come through from S&P. 500 and from some other organizations. And yeah, I think the peak amount that people put away is we all peak a little too early, and this isn't actually a great thing to do. You want to peak, you know, when you're in your 60s,
right,
and you're still able to contribute and have contributed all the way up. And just to, before everybody, just to not forget this, you know, this is the spring home buying market, and everybody knows that I love real estate and really involved as a consumer advocate for real estate. And I want to remind people that no matter how much you save for retirement, for most Americans, the bulk of their savings comes from the home equity they've built up over decades of living in their house. And so if you fail to buy a house till you're in your mid-30s, I think there's a fair chance that you're never really going to see that kind of forced savings that a mortgage actually is to add on top of the 401k
savings.
You'll
always be a little bit behind then. Elise Glink, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You bet, Steve.